I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday. Guess what?
What?
Scurvy names are extra scurvy on the 6th of January, all because it's Topsy Turvy Day!
Yay! It is Topsy Turvy Day. Happy Topsy Turvy Day. Happy Feast of Fools. We just celebrated New Year's the other day. I don't think we're quite over it yet.
The other day, I mean, not to give too much away, but like, it's been like 12 hours since we celebrated New Year's.
True, a little behind the scenes for you guys.
I'm not even sure the hangover is cleared.
So we are doing The Hunchback of Notre Dame, 1996, and we got a lot to talk about with this movie.
Yeah, we decided to skip forward a little bit because we couldn't looking at the calendar, we just couldn't turn that down.
Yeah.
It was very serendipitous. So you'll forgive us the time skip here for a bit, but yay.
We'll get back to the regular run of Renaissance Films next week.
Yeah.
But for right now, again, because of the date, we're just doing Hunchback. And there's something we got to get off the top here in terms of the timing. I mean, the era this movie was made in. I think you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. So this one starts off on Disney Plus with the warning that it contains tobacco depictions, but it mentions nothing about the unfortunate constant use of a word that we now know is considered at best a disused term, an unwanted term, and at worst a downright racial slur by the group of people it represents. We are talking about the word gypsy, and that is the only time we will use that word. We will respect the group's definition of themselves. They prefer to be called Roma or the Romani people. We will be using Roma for this podcast. So when you hear us use that word, that is the group's word for themselves. So we will respect their wishes. When this was made in 1996, I am sure that the Roma were talking about it already, that this was not a thing they liked. However, the culture had not caught up to that. And honestly, it wasn't until my 30s, I think, before I ever learned that anyone had any problem with the term used in the movie, or that it was an inaccurate term imposed upon the group. There are several inaccurate terms used for Roma, as they are traveling diaspora throughout Europe and other parts of that. At the time, people thought they had various roots. One of the French terms for the group thought they came from Bohemia as a culture. The term used in Hunchback came from the idea that some people thought they were Egyptian by heritage. It turns out that we know now that they are from the Norse of India originally as a group, and left many, many centuries ago and spread throughout. But they do trace their roots back to the northern part of the Indian subcontinent. So all the other terms imposed upon them are inaccurate, and they would like to stop being disused. So, yeah. Anyway.
So That's our explanation, and yeah, that's really all we can say on that one. So yeah. let's try to turn this around and get a little bit more positive vibe in here. 1996, you and I were in our teenage years. We were in high school when this movie came out.
Yeah, I just started high school, depending on the time of year. This would have either been
fall, I assume. Summer or fall?
Summer or fall. Summer. Summer of 96. So this would have been between my freshman and sophomore year, and I'm assuming the same for you.
Yep.
So,
spoiler,
yeah.
Me and Kiki are the same age.
Yeah, within a few months there. So this was slightly older us than some of the films we have been talking about, and we'll go back to talking about soon. But this one had a massive kind of impact on me. This was not a terribly well-received film when it came out.
I remember there was a lot of controversy around it.
We will talk about the controversies, yes, because there were some, but even just, you know, I remembered my friends being like, that one was kind of a dud, wasn't it? You know, maybe Disney is losing it.
I think it was a combination of all of these big Broadway musical style movies combined with their audience growing older. Again, once you get into that high school age, for better or for worse, you start kind of getting out of what you loved as a kid, whether you want to or not. It kind of, in a way, you kind of get through that because now you have all this stuff happening with high school. I went through it. I mean, I still loved the Disney movies back then, but it was still coming to a point like, yeah, I'm kind of burnt out of all of this.
You know, I was a very strange kid, as you may have noticed from some of the stories I've told previously. But I did have, you know, the some of the same personality change. But my personality change came a little bit earlier. Unfortunately, just for, you know, kind of sad reasons. I lost my mother at a very young age and kind of was forced into kind of a early maturing sort of section there. So by the time I was in high school, I think I already had my moody teenager phase several years before. So one of the things that happened was that I'm not entirely sure that I ever really hit the part where I was like too cool for certain things. I won't say I was uncaring about how people viewed me, but I'm not sure I entirely had enough social awareness to actually much care that everyone thought I was the weirdest kid in school. You know? So, you know, me still liking Disney movies and watching a lot of cartoons and, you know, all the other kind of quote-unquote childish things I did, I didn't much care. So I'm not sure I ever hit that too cool for Disney phase that a lot of my friends did, which I use friends loosely because I had maybe three at this point in my life. No, I had a couple of legitimately good, strong friends. I met my best friend to this day in sixth grade. So, you know, I would have had at least one incredibly strong friendship at the time. And I had a couple others that I considered strong at the time. But, you know, a lot of times they would be like, kid stuff. And I would still be like, I don't care. It's still cool. It's still awesome. And they'd be like, you're the weirdest child ever. So,
Yeah, I mean, I remember liking this movie. It's just, there's, and we'll get to it when we get through that part of the movie, is there's this part of this movie that even when I watched this, when it came out, it was like, I don't like this part. This is not, it's aiming, this is really the young kids part of the movie. And I think you know which one I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. And I had the same response to that. But I'm kind of shocked that this didn't do better than it did among the slightly older crowd at the time, like among our generation.
This movie pushed a lot. It yes, it's a G rating, but it pushes that G rating.
Yeah, this is an extremely adult film in the kind of Disney family movie animated
and canon, maybe that's why it didn't do so well. We talked about before how they've tried to go a little bit more mature with their animated movies, and it didn't do so well. So maybe, and also, you cannot do The Hunchback of Notre Dame without addressing the religious aspects in the movie. And while they do a good job of addressing that, there's going to be a section of this audience that is going to be upset over that, one way or the other.
Yeah, and Disney has kind of notoriously stayed away from a lot of religious, just in general, other than the kind of doing, like, you know, Christmas films and stuff, which they did a little bit of, but that was always kind of in a more secular, generic sense.
Mm-hmm. Never mentioned the religious aspect of Christmas. It's always Santa Claus and stuff like that.
Yeah, and also just anybody's religion. You know, they kind of stayed away from just religion in general. Even when they did Pocahontas, and we'll talk about this, you know, kind of native religion just gets kind of swept to the, like, earth and trees and colors of the wind and moving on now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really dealt with in any kind of particularity. So, but you cannot do this story without talking about Catholicism, basically.
The main story takes place in a church.
Yeah, and the motivations of, you know, several of the characters have to do with not only religion, but religious prejudice and, you know, a very twisted view of morality. So it's, you can Disney-fy it all you want, and boy did they, but you really cannot remove the idea of, you know, what Catholicism was at the time in the culture from this story.
Yeah. So let's move on. Let's talk. We've talked before. The music of this movie was written by Alan Menken. We talked about him before and his partnership with Howard Ashman in the previous movies. And, you know, he would, you know, for those who've never listened to the other ones, he did Little Shop of Horrors. He worked on Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin. After this movie, he would go on to work with DreamWorks for The Prince of Egypt, and then come back and work with Disney again to do Enchanted. So, no stranger to Disney, and a true Disney legend in Alan Menken. But we have not talked about Stephen Schwartz, who... previously, from this movie, we previously worked on, I believe, Pocahontas, if I'm right.
Yes, I think Pocahontas was his first Disney film. Mm.
And we've mentioned Stephen Schwartz when you were mentioned an interview with Alan Menken.
Yeah. In fact, there is a, if you go on Disney Plus, there is a behind-the-scenes feature attached to Beauty and the Beast, where several people who have written for Disney kind of come together and celebrate Alan Menken and talk to him about stories. And one of them is Stephen Schwartz. And he mentions that he was going to give up music entirely prior to this time in the early 90s. he had had a lot of success on the stage, kind of early in his career. Godspell and Pippin were both kind of huge successes. But he had fallen into not a great version of his career at that point.
A big slump.
Yeah, a very big slump. And he was considering just giving up musicals in specific and going on and doing other work. And Alan Menken, Disney wanted Alan Menken to continue to do work, but of course he had lost his lyricist and writing partner. And he knew Stephen Schwartz somehow, I guess, just through the musical theater scene. Mm-hmm. And he called Stephen Schwartz and said, hey, I need someone to kind of take over here and do some work with me on Disney. And he would have been talking about Pocahontas at that time. And Stephen Schwartz kind of credits that with him staying in the business, and then of course would go on to do like Wicked, which is probably the biggest success of his entire career. He would come back, for Hunchback. He would go to DreamWorks for Prince of Egypt. He would come back to Disney for Enchanted. And then he would do the Hunchback stage musical.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Hunchback stage musical. The Hunchback stage musical started in 1999 in Germany, ran for 3 years, and it became one of the longest stage productions in German history. Would not come to the States until 2016. Did off-Broadway for a bit. Was actually rejected by Broadway because of the insistence of a 32-person choir on stage throughout the entire show, and Broadway was not paying for that.
Ooh, yeah.
And the off-Broadway version had a lot of mixed reviews. So Disney itself was not exactly sure, even if they kept the 32-person choir, that they will be able to make the money back from paying these 32 people night after night after night to perform. So, and there is a version of a very early version of the stage version on YouTube that I did watch the other day. And it's very, very good. It definitely keeps a lot of the elements of the original novel while still keeping the music of the animated movie. And it's a perfect blend. It really does work. I actually sent you a video the other day of one production that actually casted a deaf actor in the role of Quasimodo, because in the book, Quasimodo is deaf.
Yeah, and that was very neat. For those out there listening, I do have some history with the deaf community and American Sign Language. One of my previous hopes was to become an interpreter. That did not work out, but I still love the language and the culture. So that is right up my alley. The thing that I know about the musical, at least in its original iteration, because it was a lot darker than the Disney film. It brought back some of the kind of more gothic elements in the book.
And really did push into a lot more of the religious aspect of it, since they do mention a lot of the verses in the Bible, a lot of Bible stories in the stage production.
Yeah. It was, even though it used the Disney music, it was strangely divorced from Disney.
It's very un-Disney-like. I'm going to, for those of you who want to see the version, a version of the stage production, look up Hunchback of Notre Dame at the La Jolla Playhouse on YouTube. It's about two hours and 8 minutes. It is a very different experience. and it honestly is one of my, now has become one of my favorite adaptations of the story.
It's great, and I love that they did it, and I love that unlike some of the musicals, which just kind of slightly expand, this one was kind of like, nope, we're gonna kind of do our own thing.
And I think that has a lot to do with the pushback that a lot of literary fans had from the animated version. We both know people who love the original books who hate the animated version because of the changes made to it.
Yeah. And I am not one of those people. But yeah, it's a bit touchy whenever you're doing something. And remember that this, the original novel was not in any way, shape, or form a children's story.
No. This is...
I mean, this was written for adults. And for a very strange reason, which was to convince the people of Paris to renovate Notre Dame, which had fallen into great disrepair at the time. And so part of the book is just talking about how amazing the architecture is and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's Victor Hugo really wanted people to think of it not as a decaying building and eyesore in Paris, but as like a central landmark.
And it worked.
Absolutely, it did work.
Even to this day, there are people who go to Paris just to see Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yeah, it wasn't the only reason I went to Paris, but it was an amazing part of my life.
You wanted to go to Euro Disney, didn't you?
Oh, no. Euro Disney would have been open by that point. But no, we went because we wanted to see Paris. We did a Paris and London trip in my senior year of high school. So that was there. But we did go to Notre Dame when I was there, and it was a very kind of profound thing, and including, you know, watching it back for the rewatch, you know, boy, did they get so much exact in their drawings of the little details.
Knowing the credits of the movie does list a Paris unit, so I'm pretty sure they sent people to Paris just to sit in front of Notre Dame all day and draw it.
That is absolutely what they did. And the thing is that there are certain things, one in particular, that people think is one of those Disney, like, cameo
the hidden
parts.
Mickeys?
No. There is apparently a warthog-looking gargoyle. And the thing is everybody's like, oh, they put Pumbaa up on the thing. But it turns out that, no, it had nothing to do with Pumbaa. That gargoyle actually exists on Notre Dame itself. And a lot of the gargoyles and the statuary that is drawn in the film is actual real things that are on the building. And if you know where to look, you can actually match up a lot of the stuff. But one of the things that I loved was the depiction of the stained glass, and especially the rose windows.
And we saw how Disney could do stained glass back in Beauty and the Beast.
But they really upped their game for this one, because it was just so beautiful, having been inside that space and then watching Esmeralda walk through that space. And it's pretty good. We do have to mention, unfortunately, that last year Notre Dame did suffer a horrific fire.
Mm-hmm.
And as of this recording, they are not entirely sure if they will be able to repair it after all. It turns out that there was a lot more structural damage than originally thought. to the base structure, and some of the people in charge of maintaining the building are now wondering that it might not be a question of fundraising, but it might just be a question of the structure is too badly damaged at this point to ever restore it, which is
sad.
Yeah, I had to teach the day of the fire, and in driving into work, we heard about the fire on the news. And when I got to my classroom, I pulled up the video, and the first part of my class was just kind of all of us sitting there staring at this image while I was trying not to cry, because visiting Notre Dame was a very kind of impactful, just architecturally. It was such a beautiful space. And it's, given the time that it was built, it was such an incredible engineering feat, because you don't have, you know, modern cranes and stuff to lift all those blocks and, you know, all that stone carving being done by hand. And it's just kind of a impressive monument to human craftsmanship.
Yeah, and when that happened, a few people tried to be smart Alex and share a certain song from this movie that referenced Notre Dame being on fire.
Yeah. Not cool.
Yeah. But I get what they were trying to do, but the guys, there's a time and place for this, not the time, not the place.
Yeah, and in fact, it was, it kind of got to me watching again after the fire, because I was like, you know, I don't know if this is ever going to be a thing again, you know. Yeah. It's, the future of Notre Dame is very up in the air right now.
So let's go to what we talked about before, which is the Disneyfication of this story. We've talked about a bit. Disney likes to break down their stories that they adapt to their base elements and form a sort of a brand new story based on them. We've seen it with Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and the more recent ones like Tangled and Frozen, which really get changed in their adaptations. But it was the adaptation of this one that really got a lot of people talking. We talked about it a little earlier, but it's like the let's be straight. Let's spoil this for a bit. All the main characters die in the book. Yeah. All the main characters die.
Yeah.
You cannot do that
for a book from the 1800s, but there's a lot of death.
You cannot do that in a Disney animated movie, because you are going to have an entire theater of crying children. And you don't really want that. So they do change a lot of in this story.
Yeah.
That
there is one main character that does get a happy ever after in the book. And that is Jolly the Goat. The goat is actually the one main character that not only survives, but actually has a happy ever after and is saved and adopted by a different character. And continues to just...
There's an entire character from the book that's not even in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Several. Quite a few.
Yeah, but, you know, they cut it down to the main... Or what they viewed were the main characters of the story and built the new story around it. So I think we've already talked for 30 minutes. So let's just dive into the movie. Hunchback of Notre Dame, 1996. The Disney Plus version actually still has the old Blue Castle logo, which I am actually surprised about.
Yeah, that was a nice little bit of happy when I was like, oh, yay, old school.
Yeah, the old school Blue Disney Castle logo with the and I think it had a lot to do with the fact that the soundtrack starts when that title starts. You actually start hearing the church bells and everything.
Yeah, you would have to re-edit that.
Yeah. So let's go into the opening song, The Bells of Notre Dame, which we've... And I cannot say that title without saying it that way.
Yeah.
That's how they say it in the movie. Go ahead.
This I love because it is very much the opening to Beauty and the Beast, mm-hmm. but super dark.
Yeah.
You know, because it starts out in a very similar way to Belle, you know? Mm-hmm. Here's the baker, and here's all these, like, provincial little people, you know, even though this is a, you know, the major city in Paris. It does start off with Clopin being like, you know, here's all the little people going about their little day.
Yeah.
And so then it just takes a turn right for...
Yeah, so we are due to... Start with our narrator, at least for this first part, Clopin, voiced by Paul Candle. And he tells us the tale of the one that rings the bell, because the bells don't ring by themselves, at least back then.
They don't?
No. And his little puppet, yeah.
I don't that puppet is amazing, and I love that. I love the puppet show aspect.
Yeah.
That they do.
So, we flash back 20 years ago, 4 Roma travelers, one with a baby. They're trying to get into Paris. But it's a setup by the Minister of Justice, Judge Claude Frollo, voiced by the late Tony Jay. Is he passed on? I'm not sure.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I want to make sure.
It was some years back, yeah.
And this is the first major change of the story, because in the book, he was the Archdeacon of Notre Dame.
Yeah, I kind of like that change a little bit, and I think they probably did it to try to avoid some of the controversy, which would have had worse controversy than they did had they kept his original job.
Can you imagine the Disney movie, even people who aren't familiar with the book, a Disney movie that has the archdeacon of a Catholic church being the villain of your story?
Yeah. So instead they split those two characters.
Yeah.
And Frollo and the Archdeacon are kind of at odds.
Which makes it which actually is a sort of a positive spot in favor of Catholicism in this movie.
Yeah, because I mean the Archdeacon seems to be a rather, you know, generous and kind man.
Yeah.
So
almost acting like Frollo's conscience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the guards are wondering what this woman is carrying. Frollo believes it to be stolen goods, and she runs to protect her child. Reaching Notre Dame, asking for sanctuary, Frollo catches up, yanks the child off, and knocks the woman down. She knocks her head on the stone stairs. She dead.
Yep.
She dead. 4 minutes into the movie, people.
Yeah, 4 minutes into the movie, and we already have, like...
our first death.
Yeah, and an on-camera death, too. I mean, they kind of spared the blood.
But
it's not like she dies off-screen. Like, you see her fall and crack her head.
Yeah, she dead. Frollo discovers that the package is a child, a deformed child he calls a monster, and he's ready to kill this child before the already mentioned Archdeacon, voiced by David Ogden Stiers, stops him. So Frollo can lie to himself that his conscience is clear, that he is a righteous man, but he just killed an innocent woman for no reason. So God himself, you know, the Archdeacon pretty much says, you cannot hide your sin from God. So, in a way to atone for what he's done, he has to raise this child. So, to, in a way, protect this child, he keeps the child in the bell tower so no one can see him, and wonders that one day the child might become of use to me. I love that line there.
Yeah, and what an immediate introduction to Frollo as a character. You know, this is very much like how we are introduced to Gaston in Beauty and the Beast. Like, you kind of know everything you need to know about Gaston in his first scene, and the same thing with Frollo.
In a way, at least to me, this whole scene kind of makes Frollo out to be one of the most villainous characters in Disney.
Like, well, he tries to drown a child within seconds of being introduced. So,
true,
yeah.
But it's like he's doing this in the name of God, in his own twisted morality.
But so I like that the Archdeacon is there to immediately say, like, this dude's going to talk a lot about how righteous and pious and godly he is, and don't believe a word of it, kids.
Yeah.
Because he immediately calls him out on, like, you're already a horrible man. Even before killing this woman, we all knew you were a horrible man. And you've just proven it, you know, by committing murder
on the steps of the church.
Yeah. And trying to throw a baby down a well.
Yeah.
Cannot stress that enough.
He tried to kill a child. That's straight up.
Yeah.
So, Frollo names the child Quasimodo, which the film says means half-formed. Not an accurate translation, but it works enough for the movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, despite how many, modern Disney movies have French connections, you know.
It's, again, there's a long definition that I don't want to go into, but for the purposes of this movie, half-formed works as the translation.
Yeah.
And I love, we see the montage of Quasimodo growing up in the style of those puppets, which is a great little, like you said, you like the puppet show, and it's like Clopin telling the story of Quasimodo to the children here. And I asked that question, what makes a monster and what makes a man? Which gets brought up several times in the movie. What is a monster? What is a man? And then we get our title. Fast forward 20 years, we see the adult Quasimodo ringing the bells. And that was the first 7 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, all of that, 7 minutes.
The funny thing is in that... behind the scenes thing for Beauty and the Beast, Alan Menken talks about how they almost didn't use Belle, the song, for the movie.
Yeah.
Because he and Howard Ashman kind of looked at each other and said, no one asked for a 6-minute opening. But here they do almost the exact same thing in almost the exact same style.
Yep.
Which I kind of admire, you know? I love both of those opening scenes just so much.
Like, you could almost release that first 7 minutes as a short by itself.
Yeah, and it is possibly one of the best exposition songs in Disney history. Everything about this movie is underrated, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But this opening just absolutely nails it. So, bravo.
So now we meet the adult Quasimodo, voiced by Tom Hulce. He is a kind person, and you see him encourage a small bird to fly. So he's very kind to animals. That's another plus on his side.
Small bird, voiced by Frank Welker. How many characters does Frank Welker have in this film? The answer is two. We will always talk about Frank Welker if we get, Welker, of course, is also Jolly the goat, of course. But this little baby bird as well.
Yeah, I mean, the whole scene is very sweet of him trying to encourage the bird to fly. And then we see this flock of birds fly by, and he's kind of encouraging, like, you know, no one wants to be cooped up here forever. Just go. And the little bird actually, you know, flies away and has a little, we never see the bird again, but he's very happy to be with his own kind again.
Yeah.
Then we meet the gargoyles. Goliath, these ones ain't. These aren't even a Broadway.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that because not too long before this movie came out, the Gargoyles TV show came out and gave myself and probably Kiki as well a very different definition of gargoyles, of a Disney gargoyle, than this movie does.
Yeah, and one day we're going to talk about that show, I promise you, but...
When we get done with the Renaissance era, we will.
Yeah, we'll get into the Disney afternoon eventually here. Hang with us. But the gargoyles are the one part of this movie I wish didn't exist. I absolutely love all three of the actors they chose. Seriously, excellent casting, but a bad idea.
I understand that you want comic relief, and I understand you want something for the young kids, but this was a bad idea.
Yeah, this ain't it, Chief.
There is one scene in this movie that justifies them, and it doesn't come up until almost the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So
strangely, the addition of the gargoyles did come from a sort of minor plot point in the book, where it does say that Quasimodo did talk to the gargoyles and confide in the gargoyles because they were the only things around.
Well, he's been 20 years alone in the tower. He's got to talk to somebody.
Yeah, and so that's where they got the idea of, you know, well, what if the gargoyles talked back and, you know, at least in his mind.
Yeah, there's a question. Are these gargoyles all in Quasimodo's imagination, or can they actually move? Because, granted, they mostly move when they're around Quasimodo. So you can think, oh, this is all in Quasimodo's head. This is his imagination. But then there's times when they're actually interacting with other characters, like with Jolly, and they're actually helping in the fight at the end of the movie.
Yeah. It's really up to you whether or not you want to think these are his, you know, imaginary friends or not.
It's done better in the stage production, where it really is all in Quasimodo's head. These are all his imaginary friends. It's because he has no one to talk to, he creates friends to talk to.
Yeah, so I think I would have liked the gargoyles better if they hadn't gone for some of the base humor that they did.
Yeah, let's introduce them. We have Victor, Charles Kinborough, Hugo, Jason Alexander, get it, Victor Hugo, and Laverne, Mary Wicks. Is this her last film role? She actually dies during production of the film. She died about a year before the movie was done. Jane Withers actually does part of the dialogue for Laverne, as well as doing the singing role. And Jane Withers would actually voice Laverne in any subsequent movie that featured. Because, yes, there is a sequel. Why? Anyway,
only Disney.
Anyway. Yeah, I'm not really a fan of the three gargoyles as they are presented in this film. Anyway, it is the day of the Feast of Fools, which is the reason we're doing this episode now. The gargoyles, they love to watch. I just messed up word up. The gargoyles love to watch.
Raising.
20 years in the bell tower, you figure it out. But Quasimodo, he doesn't want to watch anymore. You know, he wants to be a part of it. But because of the way he looks, he doesn't think that the world will accept him. Mostly because of Frollo's teachings to him. And Frollo forbids him from leaving the tower. And Frollo also hates the Feast of Fools. The gargoyles convince him to sneak out. He's about to go when in comes Frollo.
I am going to stop you because that first scene with the gargoyles does have one of the coolest shout outs. When it directly references a previous filmed version of Hunchback. At one point they're going along and Laverne chides Hugo and says, "Come on, he's not made of stone like us." Which is a direct reference to the 1939 Hunchback movie starring Charles Laughton and Maureen O'Hara, and in which the final line of the film as they also did a Disneyfication. I don't want to point out that I don't want to make it sound like Disney was the first one to change it. That movie also gave a mostly happy ending for all the main characters. But as Quasimodo watches Esmeralda and Phoebus among the crowd being cheered, as Quasimodo hides out in the bell tower and watches from above, He looks at a gargoyle, and the final line of the film is, "Why was I not made of stone like thee?" Because he's so heartbroken at, like, everybody else gets to go about their life, and he's going to remain in that tower. He's still alive at the end of that movie, but he is not, a hero of the people. He doesn't get to have friends and stuff. Esmeralda and Phoebus are just like, have fun living in the bell tower. We're going to go be, quote-unquote normal humans now. And it really is a heartbreaking scene, and it's an incredibly famous end. So I like that they directly reference that ending.
Won't be the last reference in this movie.
But I do like that they repurposed that line.
So Frollo scolds Quasi for talking to the gargoyles. Stone can't talk. But Frollo has brought in the food for them to eat. They're having lunch. And the silverware is a perfect view of how Frollo sees Quasimodo. Because Frollo has, a proper plate, a proper goblet, while Quasimodo has a wooden plate and a wooden goblet,
Yeah.
It's like the higher class, lower class thing. And going through his teachings, Quasimodo let it slip that he wants to go to the festival. Frollo does not like that. While Frollo does go to the festival, he hates it. He only goes because he has to. He's a public official, and if he doesn't go, it looks suspicious. He doesn't like the... And he pretty much says straight up, he doesn't like the fact that the low class gets free reign during the city, during the Feast of Fools. And again, that's another way of a lot of the classism that this movie has.
Yeah, and it comes up over and over again that he doesn't just hate the Roma in the movie, which he does, as they would have been the poorest and most outcast class, but he doesn't like any of the peasantry. And that comes up over and over again in the film.
And, of course, Frollo's lie about Quasimodo's mother. How he says to Quasimodo, your mother abandoned you, and I took you in, and I raised you as my own. And we just saw the opening scene, that's not what happened.
Yeah.
But this is the lie that Quasimodo's been told for 20 years.
Liar, liar, liar.
All right, let's go to our next song. Our I Want song for the movie, Out There, which is a beautiful song.
Yeah, and starts out with a very dark opening. Between him and Frollo. Mm-hmm. That first part of the song was actually how I learned the word calumny. Mm. So, yay.
Yeah, Frollo telling Quasimodo of the cruelty of the world, which he's not wrong on. He really isn't. Even today. He's not very good looking, and the world does not look kindly on less than perfect people. Again, something that's... Look at Hollywood celebrities and all that,
Yeah, look at the people who are in this movie, go look up all their pictures. All we hear is their voice, and they are still, all absolutely gorgeous people.
Demi Moore is in this movie, and she's one of the most beautiful women in the world. Jeez.
Yeah.
So, again, Frollo saying that he is the only person Quasimodo can depend on. For giving him this sanctuary of letting him essentially live in peace. But Quasimodo still wishes to live among the people one day. He just wants one day to be normal among the people. Oh, hi, Belle. What are you doing here?
No, Belle didn't just want one day. Belle wanted to leave. This I think,
No, I'm talking about Belle's in the movie.
Oh, yeah, Belle is in the movie. Yeah, that is true. A thing that I caught... in the theater without knowing it was going to be there.
We talked about before of Disney referencing past films. This was a hell of a cameo.
Yeah, walking next to the fountain reading a book. Yeah.
It is Paris. It is France, so it would make sense. It's not the right year, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Apparently somebody is carrying Pumbaa on a spit at some point in this scene.
And one of the merchants is carrying the magic carpet.
Yeah, one of the merchants is carrying the magic carpet from Aladdin. As far as the song goes, I love this song. This is one of my favorite Disney songs. It really is. And it gets to me every time. And it is such a...
song. It really is.
It really is. But also, it's like the most depressing I Want song. Because we're used to the I Want songs being kind of grand in scale. I want adventure. I want to be literally a different species so I can go live in a different society. I want to be king, you know. But Quasi just wants one day he can feel like a normal person. Like one single day. And he's not being... ironic or anything. He's like, no, I really will be okay staying here for the rest of my life. Just let me have, you know, one day of freedom and then that'll... And boy, if that doesn't break your heart, do you even have one?
Even in the end of the song where he's saying, you know, old and bent, I don't care. You know, yeah. Even if he has that one day, he will cherish it until he dies. That one day of being normal.
Yeah, and it's just such a... just such a heart-wrenching song of like, boy, you want to talk about your kind of undersold dreams there.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, it's a beautiful song.
And Tom Hulce sings it absolutely beautifully. There's so much emotion in this. And
he actually puts so much of an effort into his performance in this film itself. He actually ends up losing his voice over it.
Yeah, it was absolutely beautiful.
And meanwhile, let's catch up. We meet Captain Phoebus, voiced by Kevin Kline, and his horse Achilles, returning to Paris after being away at war. Achilles the horse, a one-joke character.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta respect them for being like, what do we name the horse? Well, let's name him Achilles and then train him to heal. Like, you know, bravo for going out of your way for that joke.
Yeah. So Phoebus notices a beautiful woman dancing for money. This is Esmeralda, voiced by Demi Moore with the singing voice of Heidi Mollenhauer. And her goat, Jolly. Phoebus is immediately infatuated with her, and Esmeralda knows it. Like, I think, honestly, I think even you could probably could instantly tell whenever someone's into you.
The thing is Esmeralda's job depends on men being into her.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if men aren't into her, because at the time, and, you know, talk about a thing we didn't really think about when we were kids, but at this time in history, Esmeralda would have been seen very similarly to a sex worker.
Yeah.
In the movie, it's kind of, she's kind of seen more as a modern belly dancer.
Yeah.
You know, as more of a street artist, a busker.
Yeah.
It is the way they portray her in the movie. But at the time, she would have been very similar to what we think of now as, you know, an adult dancer. And they do kind of make a nod to that in one of her later dance sequences where
Demi Moore was also in another movie the same year.
Yeah.
That has a lot to do with that.
Yeah. But she does, a couple of seconds of a pole dance, at one point in the film. But yeah, even though they don't really portray it that way, Esmeralda dancing at that point in history would have been very, very similar to a sex worker. Her job, though, like said, is is dependent on men being into her and playing into that idea. I don't think she actually had any interest at all in Phoebus until much, much later in the movie. Yeah.
Well, when she actually gets to know his actual character.
Because remember in the Feast of Fools scene, she does the same thing basically with Frollo, and yes. She is never into him. But in that original dance scene, she is portraying, you know, the thing. So remember that dancers are not into you. Just because they dance for you, there doesn't mean that they want you.
They're doing a job.
Yeah, they're doing a job.
Yeah, so the guards come and they try to arrest Esmeralda because they believe that her kind, they don't earn money, they steal it. But Phoebus actually kind of stops the whole thing, you know, using the horse to block the guards. Here's our Achilles heel joke. And, or Achilles sit, rather.
Yeah.
And pretty much allowing Esmeralda to get away. And that is the first instance of Phoebus's character, of a noble person, versus the other guards, which are just kind of in it, you know, they're getting enjoyment out of punishing the lower class. Again, that's something that still happens to this day.
Yeah, you know, he is a good guy that is in an irredeemable job.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. But also, I don't know if in the context of the movie, at least, we're supposed to think that his intention was to become captain of the city guard and, you know, what is basically amounts to law enforcement then, before we had the modern idea of policing. Mm-hmm. He was a soldier in the service of his country. And Frollo chooses him, you know.
Yeah, Frollo chooses him to come home from war to be the new captain of the guard.
Yeah.
So, let's go to that. Frollo and Phoebus meeting and informing Phoebus of what he calls the real war. And that is Frollo's war against the Roma people. They don't live the same way that he does. They don't follow the ways of the church.
Which is ironic, because they actually do. Even at the time, most Roman people were Catholic. Mm. Which is something the movie kind of glosses over. And there's one line in God Help the Outcasts where Esmeralda says, you know, help my people, they look to you still. Mm-hmm. But also she seems a little confused about the story of Jesus at the beginning of that day. So I'm not sure how much the writers actually knew about the history of the Roma people, but quite a lot of them are Catholic and have been for quite some time and would have been at this time.
And of course, the imagery of Frollo equating the Roma people to these ants in the cracks of the stones.
Yeah.
How he views them. Symbolism.
Well, the thing is that the writers were very clear that they wanted Frollo and his motivations to be based on some of the most famous genocidal cultures in history. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what Frollo is attempting to do. He wants Phoebus to come home and wage a war, but more specifically a genocide. Mm-hmm. It was his skill as a soldier and all that comes with that Frollo really wanted.
Mm-hmm. And Frollo wants to find the safe haven for the Roma, the Court of Miracles, and just take them all out once. But it's time for the festival, as Frollo and Phoebus attend, as well as Quasimodo in disguise, which leads us to the song Topsy Turvy, which where we, you know, 6th of January and all that.
Yeah.
Quasi gets in trouble right away, and Clopin doesn't help matters. Poor Quasi. eventually, you know, he's getting all these dancers, he's kind of getting involved with them kind of reluctantly, eventually stumbling in on Esmeralda changing. 1 second before or after, he probably would have saw a lot more of Esmeralda than you could have in a Disney movie.
Yeah.
But in a way, you see more of Esmeralda's kind heart is that she's more concerned if Quasimodo's okay because he literally fell.
Yeah, once she realizes that it was an accident that he's in her tent and not, you know, anything.
Not that he's a creeper or anything, you know.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's worried, are you okay? And Quasi, of course, is worried. He doesn't want his face being seen because it's so ugly. And Esmeralda thinks, oh, that's a great looking mask. You can go have some fun. But we know he's not wearing one. Let's fast forward to Esmeralda's dance on the stage. We just mentioned it earlier. Frollo disgusted over the whole thing. And I love the line there. You know, look at that disgusting display. And Phoebus going, yes, sir.
Yeah, absolutely, sir. That's a great part of the job. I'll be in there.
Keep in mind that, you know, 5 minutes earlier, Phoebus just saw this woman dance and was completely enchanted with her. So, I get to see this woman dance again. Okay, sir. And, I mean, some people have taken, oh, you know, men are pigs. Like, yeah. I mean, beautiful woman dancing, yeah. He's going to look. I mean, it's not an excuse. It's just, yeah.
But also, Esmeralda puts on a really good show. Like, even beyond that, she does seem to be, like, an incredibly accomplished both dancer and illusionist. Stage magic in that sense.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned before, Esmeralda dances right up to Frollo. And this kind of plays with him, you know, shoving his hat down, throwing the scarf at him. And this starts Frollo's infatuation with Esmeralda. And it goes, she grabs the spear from the guard, does her pole dance with it. Again, definitely reminiscent to another movie that she was in the same year.
Yeah. And in fact, that was a controversy. That was part of the controversy is she was given... what was at the time kind of a never before imagined amount of money to star in what was basically softcore adult film. I mean, it was released in a mainstream theater and stuff like that, but let's not kid ourselves.
Striptease, that's the name of the movie, folks. We go to Dance Reno. Striptease, I was a teenage boy in 1996. Yeah, I saw it.
I have never seen that one, actually. It's supposed to be kind of not as infamously bad as Showgirls, but not a good movie. And
no,
I do have a soft spot in my heart for bad film. But that's just one that I've never... It never seemed hilariously bad enough that I had to see it, unlike something like Showgirls. But I don't know. You know.
So let's go forward to the crowning of the King of Fools. The ugliest in Paris will be crowned the king. And naturally, Quasimodo wins. Because he is the ugliest in Paris. Much to Frollo's dismay. Because he just did not want Quasimodo to leave the tower. And, you know, that's where our song ends. It's a big finale of Topsy Turvy. It's a great song. And, again, it's a lot more people know of January 6th because of this song than anything else.
Yeah, and the Feast of Fools was actually a real, you know, it was a real feast day back in the time that would have been celebrated in France. So they weren't getting this out of nowhere.
It's the actual 12th day of Christmas. It is 12 days after Christmas.
Yeah. They would have celebrated Twelfth Night and most of the other in the English speaking world. But in that part of France, there was the Festival of Fools instead of Twelfth Night.
Yeah. So just when Quasimodo thinks he's been accepted, that the people have accepted him, that he is the King of Fools, the guards start throwing tomatoes at him. Then the rest of the people start throwing things at him. Then he gets tied down and humiliated, and oh, this has not turned out to be a good day for Quasimodo. Poor Quasi. You kind of feel sorry for him. It's like, all he wanted was to just get out and have one day among the people, and this happens.
But, you know, I am going to say something on the rewatch that I immediately was like, you know what? You should have let Paris burn, Quasi. These people did not deserve saving.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is the most fickle crowd in history. And it remains through the movie, you know, is that they'll, you know, one second they're like, you know, throw fruit at him. And then they're like, no, crown him this. And no, tie him down and beat him. And it's, you know, so I don't know.
So Phoebus wants to stop this. This is cruelty. He's going to stop this person from being humiliated. And Frollo's stopping him, saying that Quasimodo needs to learn a lesson. But it's Esmeralda that causes everyone to stop. And Frollo, again, tries to stop her. But Esmeralda frees Quasimodo. And this is where we get Esmeralda standing up to Frollo, saying that her people have been persecuted since he became the judge. And she wants justice for her people.
Yeah, that I love that silence justice meme has been going around, because that is really just such an excellent part of the movie. Yeah. And Esmeralda, as portrayed here, is such a great character. Mm-hmm. And I love everything about this. Is a highly political film for Disney.
Yeah.
And less subtle about it than something like Aladdin was. So
Frollo calls for her arrest for interfering in the humiliation of Quasimodo, or insubordination to Judge Frollo. Take your pick. And Esmeralda escapes with that stage magic, and Frollo calls it witchcraft. Again, not too different. I mean, you could have stage musicians, magicians, I can talk. Stage performers doing that kind of thing and was considered witchcraft. But then again, it's not too long after in the States, people just called it witchcraft just because they cook an egg. You know?
This was you know, probably an excuse, but also Esmeralda is basically Batman in this scene. Like, let's not.
This is Disney. She's Darkwing Duck.
Yeah.
With the smoke.
Yeah, but that kind of smoke bomb disappearing ninja trick, that they use at several points, in the movie and this scene especially. But witchcraft was typically just the thing you screamed at the time whenever a woman wasn't doing what you wanted her to do. let's be clear on the motivations there.
Yeah, that will come up. The whole sequence of Esmeralda's escape is beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great chase scene.
It's honestly, I would say this is a better chase scene than the one in Aladdin.
Oh yeah, it's really good. It's funny. It's colorful. You know, all the places they have her pop up.
And Esmeralda really can defend herself to the point that Phoebus is impressed.
Yeah, Phoebus is like, what a woman.
Is like, because, you know, she can defend herself. She can fight off pretty much the entire royal guard on her own. And, but she does get help. Some of the other performers do help her out, and she does escape with a stage magic trick.
Yeah. And I do like the fact that the Roma are shown throughout the film to be very helpful, not only to other people, but also to each other. Especially to each other. We mostly see kindness to others via Esmeralda, but you know, we see it again later in the movie, you know, that these are people who will stand for their own. You know, they know that a large chunk of the world is against them, and they're going to rally together and protect their own, which I kind of admire.
So Frollo calls for the search for Esmeralda, and Quasimodo, embarrassed and disgraced, just slowly walks back to Notre Dame. That walk of shame, it's heartbreaking almost.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but Phoebus actually notices Esmeralda in disguise going into Notre Dame. How he noticed that was Esmeralda, I don't know.
Oh, because she's got the goat on top of her head pretending to be the old man, which he has already seen earlier in the movie.
Ah, we skipped that part over. But yeah.
And, I love that the tobacco depictions in this movie are entirely the
goat.
The goat. Well, the goat and one scene of Jason Alexander and using a sausage as a cigar.
Yeah. So, there's more alcohol depictions than tobacco descriptions in this movie.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Especially with in the Topsy Turvy, where one of the stilt walker gets a cork right in its crotch from one of the open champagne bottles.
Yeah.
Because this is 1996, and that's comedy. Then we get Phoebus confronting Esmeralda in the church, and these two have a pretty good, decent fight scene, where Esmeralda is actually impressing Phoebus with her skills as a fighter. You fight just as well as a man. Oh, I was going to say the same thing about you. And there's a lot of funny one-liners, like Phoebus saying, "I just shaved this morning."
You missed a spot.
Yeah. Like, these two the characters have a very good chemistry with each other here. Granted, again, Kevin Kline and Demi Moore probably never met at all doing the voices for this one, but it worked in this scene.
There's just something about Kevin Kline, though, in pretty much all of his roles, that he can figure out kind of chemistry with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure you could put him on stage with a cactus and he could sell that he had chemistry with the cactus.
Yeah.
You know, he's just an incredibly amazing actor. And one of the few kind of name actors that I will absolutely say I respect as a voice actor as well. He really does give it all in his vocal performances and has seemed to have learned enough about the craft to know the particulars of acting in that medium. So
we have Frollo finding them and orders for Esmeralda's arrest. Phoebus saves her by saying she claims sanctuary. That's, again, it's a note to Phoebus's character. He could have easily said, you know, take her away, do this, but he's saying, no, this woman claims sanctuary. We can't do anything about it. But Frollo knows that her kind doesn't do well confined, so he'll wait her out. And he straight up creeps on her, smelling her hair and everything.
Yeah, that I know what you were thinking. Line.
Yeah.
Talk about lines that the children get. We were old enough that we were starting to get it at the time. But. Yeah.
Creepy old man on a young woman. That's another notch on Frollo being one of the more evil Disney villains.
You know, to me, the age doesn't even have that much to do with it, as they are, unlike many Disney characters at the time, all of these people are supposed to be adults in this film. But I don't care what the age difference is. Don't do any of that to someone that you don't know and who hasn't specifically told you that it's okay to do any of those things.
Don't be a creeper, guys. Don't be a creeper.
Yeah.
Which leads us... there's the conversation between Esmeralda and the Archdeacon. That I don't have it in my notes, but I didn't want to mention that, of the Archdeacon kind of telling Esmeralda, you know, maybe you could find an answer, someone here can help you. Now, you think that, oh, he's talking about God, but, you know, it's kind of Quasimodo in this one.
Yeah, we do know that the Archdeacon maybe not as directly interacting with Quasimodo as much as Frollo has, but the Archdeacon does seem to be a sort of fatherly figure as well, in the sense that he wants Quasi to be okay and be, you know.
So it's sort of the angel-devil kind of scenario, but with Quasimodo, the angel's the Archdeacon and the devil is Frollo, almost.
Yeah.
But which leads us to what I consider to be the best song in the movie, God Help the Outcasts.
It is a great song. Not even going to lie.
It's literally a prayer to God in song form.
Yeah.
So, you know, Esmeralda asks God for help for her people, and it's a very selfless prayer. She just wants her people to be safe. She asks for nothing for herself. Meanwhile, we have the other partitioners asking for very selfish things. Wealth, fame, love.
Not just love. Love I can possess, which is a very clear distinction in the movie. We see a very clear distinction between the sort of love that Quasimodo has and the sort of desire that Frollo has when it comes to Esmeralda. Mm-hmm. You know, Quasi has a very non-possessive, non-jealous sort of love.
It's an innocent love. It's puppy love, pretty much.
Maybe. I'm not sure I would infantilize Quasi quite that much. But Frollo is very much a possessive love. Yeah. He doesn't want her to love him. He just wants her to be his.
Kind of like Gaston with Belle.
Yes. I consider Frollo and Gaston to be, parallel characters in many, many ways. But I love this song because this is very much, once again, the class divide that they bring up over and over and over again in the film. And once again, it's a very political song. Because the interesting thing is that people think that Esmeralda is praying for the Roma, and she is. I'm not going to say she's not. But the way it is phrased...
She's just the poor. The downtrodden.
The poor, the downtrodden, you know, any kind of marginalized people seem to fall under her definition of her people. Mm-hmm. That it's not a specific, you know, cultural or ethnic group. It's just, you know, everybody that's getting the short end of the stick here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love the way Stephen Schwartz is very specific in his word choices, even more so than a lot of other lyricists, I would argue. And he has a lot of incredibly specific lyrics in this film.
I love that beginning part too, where she looking at the statue of Jesus and saying, "Weren't you once an outcast too?"
Yeah, and that was the part I was talking about, that she seems a little, you know, I wonder, were you an outcast? And I wanted to be like, well, you would have known. You know, that's been a part of the Jesus story for longer than...
I think it's more
than...
her just straight up asking Jesus, you know, weren't you, you know, you were an outcast just as much as I am an outcast now. You know, a little help here.
Yeah.
At least that's how I understood it when I first saw the movie.
Once again, the lyrics are kind of specific here, and it's, you know, I see your face and wonder, were you once an outcast too? Not weren't you, in the sense of, hey, remember you were an outcast, but it seems to be much more questioning. Which, once again, I kind of wonder how much cultural background they did here, and I'm thinking probably not a lot.
All right, so let's move on. Quasimodo, having heard Esmeralda, goes down to see her, and the churchgoers kind of shun him for what happened earlier in the day. It wasn't really his fault, though, but they're blaming him anyway.
Yeah, I don't know how any of that could be thought of as his fault.
Well, he showed his face, and his face riled everybody up, so it's his fault for looking ugly.
Hey, it's your fault we hurt you and threw... Wow, you want to talk about some intense victim blaming there.
Yeah. So, eventually, Esmeralda catches up to him, and these two definitely get along quite well. Quasi even gives Esmeralda the tour of the bell tower. Especially, we didn't mention yet, but the figurines that that Quasimodo has made. He's made the figurines of everyone in the town, including Notre Dame itself.
Yeah, and I'm really beautiful work. He's also made like light catchers using old bits of stained glass, which I love, to brighten the room and give it some color. There's just all these little kind of art projects of Quasi's around the tower, which I like.
It gave him a little bit more of a personality, you know, giving him that, you know, he's an artist, so you know, he does have something to of value to the world, you know? Not just he's this ugly guy that lives alone. And it's a very tender moment. The whole scene is very tender between the two of them, as these two really do grow and become real friends in this one scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, granted, Quasimodo, having no one really ever shown him any kindness, in a way, this friendship for him is seen more as romantic love, but it's a very tender moment between the two.
Yeah, her palm reading of him is one of my favorite parts of the scene.
Yeah, I know. You have a long lifeline. I don't see any monster lines.
Yeah. I also love the way that it's animated and a little bit in the way that it's acted, but especially in the animation, they make it very clear that, like, she's just making this up as she goes along.
Yeah.
Oh, look, a long lifeline. This one says you're shy. This one says, you know, just naming off things she's already figured out about him. Which, you know, bravo to them for including that, and maybe I'll leave it there.
Yeah. So, Quasi actually helps Esmeralda escape. In exchange, he gives him a woven band in case he himself ever needed sanctuary. When you hold this woven band, you hold the city in your hand. And then, as Quasimodo re-enters the bell tower, Phoebe shows up. And Quasi doesn't like that because he equates any of the soldiers as working with Frollo. So he just wants her to leave. He throws the torch, you know, no soldier, sanctuary, sanctuary. But amazingly, Phoebus is there to apologize to Esmeralda for putting her in this situation, knowing that she doesn't want to be in this situation. And again, that's another part of Phoebus' character, showing that he does have honor in a way.
Yeah, and admits that he did it to save her life, which I think is the thing that Quasi's like, okay, you know, I maybe won't hurt you, but leave.
Yeah, you're like, okay, you're not a complete a-hole, but I don't want you here anyway.
Yeah.
And yeah, he also says that Esmeralda is lucky to have Quasi as a friend. To, you know, someone that would go as far as he did to, you know, go, well, as far as he will go in later in the movie to kind of protect her.
Yeah.
Which leads us to the song "Heaven's Light."
Well, I'm gonna back up just one second. There is that we do get the first real show of Quasimodo as this week's Secretly Swole. We've got another Secretly Swole.
How is it Secretly Swole? He pulls those bell strings, those ropes carrying the bell. That ain't secretly strong.
But the thing is that even with, and this was always a part of the story, is that yes, he was strong for pulling the bells, but every time a character comes up against Quasimodo, they are astounded by his strength. And like I said, this was, you know, in the story from the beginning, that he is not just strong, but like freakishly strong.
Yeah.
And especially given how he looks.
Yeah.
You know, that
especially his deformity, the hunchback, the misshapen body. So he's very strong for someone not only human in general, but someone in that shape.
Okay, I'm calling it secretly swole because unlike a character like Gaston, you know, who he's got the muscles and, it, you know, if he picks up, you know, a bench with three women on it, people are like, oh, that is very impressive feat. But it is Gaston. He is very strong, you know, whereas the when Quasi does it, people are like, oh, wow, we didn't expect that. I mean, Phoebus in this scene is very much like, could you put me down?
And that scene is played for as a joke, and it works as a joke. It's like, okay, can you put me down, please?
Yeah.
It's almost like he's embarrassed that this short guy is essentially stronger than he is.
Yeah, and, you know, we see increasing feats of strength from Quasi throughout the film, but this is kind of our first taste that he's remarkably strong, you know.
He appears.
Because, yeah, I mean, the rope and pulling on the bells, you know, even at the time, you know, with pulleys and stuff, you can offset a lot of that weight. So he would have still been strong, but this is his first kind of little entrance into the, oh, he is freakishly strong. So.
All right, so let's get to the song Heaven's Light. The you know, the line, no face as hideous as my face was ever meant for Heaven's Light. It's kind of, again, it's a little bit of a heartbreaking because that's how he sees himself. But he sees, you know, he equates Esmeralda to this angel that has come into his life. And just how, in a way, his worldview is now changing because this person is in his life. And amazingly for him, how fast he can make that Esmeralda figure.
Yeah, I mean, he's really good at...
at whittling.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just... I mean, it's almost like a second I want song. Because Quasi wants love. He wants someone to love and someone to love him. And it's... you were telling before of a low standard of a dream. It's like... That's basic right there.
You know, the thing is he doesn't even say in the song, really, that that this is a thing he ever wanted. His standards are so low, it's a thing he always thought was...
impossible.
Yeah, completely impossible. And at this point, you know, the gargoyles... will kind of tell him, like, oh, she's in love with you. Oh, we saw the way she looked at you and everything. But according to this song, and according to what he says to the gargoyles later, that's not even what he's thinking of. I mean, he does talk about, you know, pair of lovers and the glow and everything. But I don't think that even to himself, he really... believes that she's capable of that, even in her kindness, at this point. So I don't know. I love everything about this song. I love the way it's constructed, and I love the way it leads into the next song.
Yeah, straight up, we go straight into Hellfire. I mean, these two are so connected; they're the same song on the soundtrack.
Yeah. It is listed as Heaven's Light / Hellfire on the soundtrack.
And these two songs, even before we were even talking about doing the podcast, you were talking about how these songs are even more connected, or even talking about the song Hellfire itself.
Yeah, I consider this to be hands down the best villain song in Disney history. And there are a lot of good Disney villain songs. I mean, Be Prepared is an excellent one, you know, that we will talk about probably at length in that episode. I absolutely love Poor Unfortunate Souls. But there is something above and beyond in this song that I think has never been matched. thus far in Disney history.
My favorite parts of this song, not just the lyrics, but it's the Latin. If you translate the Latin that the choir is singing, it's pretty much antithesis and complements almost the English words that Tony J is singing.
Well, yeah, these are actually typical Catholic Latin prayers. They weren't translated out of nothing or written in English first and everything, but these are typical phrases you would find in a confessional. They are typical parts of the liturgy. And they all have very specific meanings about confession and asking for forgiveness and all, and doing the one thing Frollo can't do, which is, you know, mea culpa. It's my fault. You know, there is a responsibility in the Latin that Frollo never achieves. The Latin phrases are all about recognizing that you have done something wrong and you are asking God to forgive you. Whereas Frollo's entire song is someone else is doing something wrong and let God come down on them. So yeah, I love that juxtaposition.
The whole song, like we did with God Bless the Outcast, this is another prayer in a song. You know, he's trying to pray his lust away. He has convinced himself that Esmeralda, as a witch, has put a spell on him. That's why he's never had these feelings before over Esmeralda get there. So Esmeralda must have put a spell on her, a spell on him to put these impure thoughts into his head. And he can't decide if he wants to bang her or kill her.
Yeah.
And ultimately decides if she will not sleep with him, then she will die. Destroy Esmeralda or make her mine and mine alone. Or she will be mine or she will burn.
Yeah.
And it's very much, this is a song that really does mean more now than it did then.
I mean, it meant a lot then. I mean, trust me, once again, I'm coming from a female perspective here, but, yeah, Frollo to me is only rivaled by Gaston in how realistic a villain he is. Mm-hmm. The other Disney villains have, I'm a witch who wants to be the most beautiful in the world. I'm a sea witch who just wants power. I'm a lion who really wants to be Hitler. You know, it's like there's always something slightly above and beyond about them. But with both Gaston and Frollo, it's just, I want the pretty girl who doesn't want me, and I want people to admire me.
It's almost
which is a very grounded and unfortunately incredibly realistic villain story there.
It also plays with Frollo and his righteousness. Frollo, the reason that Frollo is such a great villain is that he believes himself to be just. He believes himself to be holy. Most of the Disney villains, they know they're villains. They know what they're doing is evil, and they relish in doing evil. Frollo thinks he's doing the work of God.
Yeah, Gaston, it's a little bit 50-50. Like, he knows there are some lines he crosses, but he definitely thinks that he is the good guy versus the beast. And that he is saving the town. Side effect, I get Bella's a prize. But, he definitely knows that he's crossing some lines in his plot to make Belle marry him. Mm-hmm. But he does think of himself as the good guy and the savior and protector of the town. Frollo is a step beyond that. Frollo sees nothing underhanded, even in his worst methods. Mm-hmm. You know, he's telling the guy at the beginning exactly how to torture a prisoner. Mm-hmm. And he sees which nothing may or may not, wrong. May or,
the prisoner may or may not have been the previous captain of the guard.
Yeah, highly suggested that it was the previous captain of the guard. But everything he does, he has no second thought about it. The closest he gets is in Hellfire, where he understands that lust is a sin in a kind of generic way, but once again, he takes no responsibility for it. It's all Esmeralda's fault.
Yeah.
You know, she's done something, which is unfortunately too realistic a view. You know, it is a common line, you know. I mean, growing up in kind of hyper-religious cultures, like I did, especially as a woman, you're taught a lot of times that it's your fault if a man does bad things to you. You know, that if he has ill intention, it is somehow your fault. You must have dressed incorrectly or spoken to him incorrectly or led him on by flirting. And all of that is there in Frollo.
Yeah, even today, you know, it's people are making those excuses even in, you know, today. And it's...
Yeah. And it has pervaded the larger culture, but in these kind of, you know, in the Catholic culture of the time, and arguably in some of the Catholic culture still today, and in a lot of kind of fundamentalist Orthodox religious cultures, that is the view, is it wouldn't have been Frollo's fault. You know, at the time, if Frollo said, you know, I'm having feelings of lust because this woman was dancing in a skimpy outfit, probably even the good and kind archdeacon would have been like, oh yes, you're right, she was doing something wrong, that is totally her fault. But the song makes it clear, once again, clear in giant quotation marks, because you do have to know Latin liturgy, I think, to fully understand it. But the other part of the song is making clear, like, no, Frollo, this is your fault. You know.
I can't find it right now, but I have the soundtrack on CD, and I'm pretty sure that the Latin is translated on the lyrics of that CD.
Yeah, I do believe that it is, in the matter. But it's, you can translate the lyrics and still not have the cultural context.
Yeah.
Which I think is also a part of it. In the way these phrases are used in, you know, some of the rituals of the Catholic Church. But I do like that the song does provide a counterpoint to Frollo, even if it is in Latin.
Yeah. So let's move on. We've talked enough about the song. So next day,
you can never talk enough about Hellfire, in my opinion. It's just a brilliant, brilliant song.
Next day, Frollo gives the order, find the girl. And honestly, this scene feels like it got cut, because it feels like he was going to say something else and then gets cut to the next scene. Anyway, they go to every Roma house or whatever they can find, offering money in exchange for where Esmeralda is. Nobody talks. And
I do love that he is offering pieces of silver.
Not gold, silver.
Yeah, I mean, biblically, that is a very, you know, offering pieces of silver for the whereabouts of the accused is a very biblical thing, because it was what was offered for Jesus, you know.
And, you know, each time Frollo is offering more and more money to find where Esmeralda is.
Yeah.
And again, no one talks, and they're arrested. Even one family even has their cart thrown into the water with them still in it.
Yeah, watching that Bardo sink was just so... Oh, that's such a beautiful Bardo. Don't do that.
And you could and they make a point that Phoebus doesn't like where this is going. This is not an honorable act. Phoebus finally has enough when he's asked to burn down the house of a miller who has previously, it's been established previously, that he's always welcomed in travelers to his home. And there's no one there at the house, but Frollo's asking for the house to get burned down and the family under house arrest. And Phoebus refuses to do it. He will not torture an innocent person. And he even, you know, douses out the torch when he's giving it to him. And Frollo burns it himself because he calls Phoebus a coward. But Phoebus actually dives in, so much of a coward, that he dives into the burning building and saves the family.
Yeah. So we've had Frollo attempt to drown a child, an infant, a newborn, at the beginning of the film. And now he tries to burn an entire family, including another newborn, alive, because the mother is holding an infant in her arms when they're rescued. So, man, Frollo and the infanticide, it's a running theme.
Yeah. So, Frollo sees what this is insubordination, and insubordination is death. But Esmeralda is there. Esmeralda actually helps Phoebus escape. But
I love Phoebus's line as he is about to be executed.
Yeah,
that it was his great honor to be insubordinate. It's like,
well, his order was to harm innocent people, and he was not going to do it.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, we can talk for ages on the dubious lessons that Disney movies have taught children over the decades. But this is actually one of the great ones. You know, yes, that is technically a lawful order. You know, Frollo is the person in command. And he would have had that leeway in the culture at the time. But, you know, Phoebus stands up and draws a clear line that some things can be lawful and completely unethical. Mm-hmm. And when the law is unethical, you have a duty to refuse to follow that law, you know, which is... The writers were already trying to draw parallels between Frollo and very specifically the Nazis, by their own admission. And Phoebus was absolutely like, you know, I'm not going to end up at Nuremberg. You know, I'm not following orders on this one, which I think is a great move and makes him worthy in the end of Esmeralda's affection.
Because, you know, Esmeralda sees it. He sees the kind soul that Phoebus has. He's not going to harm an innocent person.
Yeah, and he's not just being kind to Esmeralda because he thinks she's pretty and he wants something in return for her. He is absolutely willing to lay down his life for just a random family, which I think is even more proof. You know, if it had just remained to like, well, he was always kind to Esmeralda, there is a wonder of like, was he kind to her because he was kind, or was he kind to her because she was pretty and he wanted something? But this family has nothing to give him. It's very obvious that they're relatively poor. You know, he's not doing this for any kind of reward. There is a small group around, but it's not like he's doing it to grandstand in front of a crowd. It's just, there's a great line in Babylon 5 of like, how do you know the heroes? It's one person in the dark willing to sacrifice their life for somebody else without any fame or glory or monuments to their name. You know, that's how you know the really good people. And I think Phoebus meets that definition in this scene.
So Esmeralda helps Phoebus escape, but not before he's hit by an arrow from one of the guards.
Into the river he goes.
Yeah. As far as Frollo knows, he's dead.
Yeah.
But again, you know, kudos on Esmeralda and the ingenuity to do to make that slingshot out of her own headband or whatever it was.
Yeah. And slingshots are really that kind of slingshot especially is really difficult to control and aim with. So, you know, she gets a sharpshooter shot off of that.
Well, we've seen earlier in the movie that she knows how to defend herself. So she's
absolutely, but you know, still that's just impressive.
So Frollo kind of figures it out that it was Quasimodo that helped Esmeralda escape. You know, I had guards at every door. No, how did he escape? Unless. So, Paris is burning. Frollo has decided to set every house in Paris on fire in an effort to smoke out, literally, Esmeralda. And this is where we're... we have to talk about this one, then. Quasimodo's worried, and the gargoyles, like you said, gargoyles saying, oh, Esmeralda will come back because she knows you want him, and she wants you, and let's get to the song, A Guy Like You. I don't like the song.
I know what they were trying to do with this song. I understand it as a thing, you know, as a creation. However, given the way that they decided to play out the rest of the movie, this song, if... I don't know if it's better or worse if you consider the gargoyles figments of his imagination. Like, is this just his imagination trying to give himself hope and pump himself up, or is this an external group of beings? Like, I don't know. But there's something about this song that comes off as a bit shallow and cruel, given the way the rest of the movie plays out.
Yeah, I have it in my notes. I used to really like this song when it first came out, because it's upbeat, it's peppy, it's kind of diluting the negativity. It was kind of giving a little uplift while this whole sad moment is happening. I kind of get what they're trying to do there, but I really, as I've grown older, watched this movie again, I really don't like the song anymore, mostly because it sets up Quasimodo to fail.
Yeah. Like I just said, you can talk a lot about the, you know, weird lessons learned. You could spin this as a song about, like, body positivity and everyone deserves love, but it kind of doesn't come off that way as an
adult. This girl was nice to you once, must mean she really, really wants you.
Yeah.
Especially with what comes, like you said, what comes after this part of the movie.
Yeah, and I guess if you consider this his imagination, you know, it
especially
is
with,
true
with
that,
the visuals, you know.
Well, yeah.
With Laverne on the piano and a very Jessica Rabbit, Fabulous Baker Boy style thing.
Yeah, that was mildly disturbing, considering they set Laverne up to be a very maternal figure to Quasi up until this point of the movie, and then they do that.
Yeah.
I don't know. There is... Yeah, I think you've got it correct in the fact that, like, it is realistic that someone who's never known kindness of any sort would or could, you know, it's not a given, but could translate any kindness as this must be romantic love. Because from a distance, that's all he's seen. Mm-hmm. You know, he would have seen, you know, parents with their children, and that being a very obvious affection, but that definitely isn't the relationship. But the only kind of peer relationship of, like, kindness and affection that he probably would have seen from a distance would have been a romantic couple, you know, like he says. Because it's much harder to see from a distance platonic kindness. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the other little things that friendly affection and, you know, platonic love even. You know, which is a thing, you know, the non-romantic versions of love. So, like I said, I don't know if it's better or worse if this is all his imagination. Because in his imagination, you can kind of rationalize it as he has mistaken this entire situation and he's trying to psych himself up about it.
Yeah.
I think it's a little worse if you take the gargoyles as
independent beings.
Yeah, independent beings. But then again, they're stuck in the same position as him, you know? What do they know? You know? I don't know. We don't know anything about gargoyle society in this.
So let's pass this song here. As Esmeralda brings Phoebus to the tower, nurses him back to health. The very funny one-liner with the wine being poured in the wound.
Yeah.
That wasn't a good year. And the two share a kiss, a romantic kiss, because Esmeralda has fallen for Phoebus, mostly because she sees that he is a kind soul, and he does have honor. And
and to borrow a line from The Simpsons, if you pause it, you can see the exact moment Quasimodo's heart breaks in half.
Yeah, he is crushed, and you kind of feel for him. I felt for him.
Especially still as an adult, I'm like, oh man, I know that pain.
The moment where you see your crush and they're with someone else and they're all happy, you want to be happy for them, but it's like, oh, rip my heart out, why don't you?
Yeah.
That reprise of Heaven's Light as it's happening too.
Oh yeah, that is like a extra twist of the knife right there. Like, woof.
Because in the beginning he says, I thought I'd never know. And now at this point he says, I knew I'd never know.
Yeah.
It's like he knew this was going to happen and he let it happen anyway because he wanted to believe that there's someone that could care for him, you know?
Yeah.
No time to cry because Frollo has arrived. And Esmeralda escapes. And Frollo is very suspicious of Quasimodo's actions because Quasi has no chill. None. Bluffing is not his strong suit. But then again, he spent 20 years in a tower. He's really never had that life experience to bluff anything.
Yeah, it seems like he may have talked to all of two human beings in his entire life until this movie starts.
Yeah. So, Frollo actually puts all of the blame of what's going on Quasimodo. Because, you know, this whole thing was because you went outside the tower. This is your fault. You let her escape. This is all, you know, Paris is burning because of you. And Frollo says he knows where the Court of Miracles is, and he will attack at dawn with 1,000 men. And once he leaves, and he leaves with that smirk, they make sure you see that smirk on his face.
Yeah.
He is straight up playing Quasimodo like a fiddle.
Yeah. And once again in this scene, we also see that Frollo is once again completely unwilling to take any responsibility for his actions.
Yeah.
You know.
And he burns the Esmeralda figure. That's just straight up.
Yeah. That's some extra cruelty.
But yeah, he's refusing to take responsibility for his own actions.
You are the reason I am burning Paris. Look what you made me do, Quasi. You know, it's absolutely the words of an abusive figure.
Okay, T-Swift. Yeah, so Phoebus and eventually Quasimodo go out to find the court before Frollo can. And they discover that the Woven Band is a map that will lead them to the Court of Miracles.
I kind of really want to make one of those necklaces, you know, now that I make some jewelry and other crafty things.
You can put those things on Etsy and it'll sell.
Actually, there is one on Etsy right now. I did look into it last night. There is one person on Etsy selling
them. Is it just called Esmeralda's Band or Hunchback of Notre Dame Band?
No, it's called like map of Paris necklace or something like that, and then it says like film version or something. But it says that the seller originally created it as a prop for a stage play, and then now they're just selling them to like cosplayers and fans. But they're selling them for like $40 American, so you know, that is a tiny little profit there.
So they go into the map leads them into a cemetery where they find the entrance to the Court of Miracles and are ambushed. Leads us into our next song, The Court of Miracles, which Clopin and the other Roma people tie and gag up Quasi and Phoebus and set them up to hang.
Yeah, this is, you want to talk about your outdated cultural depictions.
Yeah. No witnesses.
Well, not just that. I mean, you can kind of understand why they wouldn't want outsiders to be able to tell, especially the captain of the guard, because they haven't necessarily witnessed his good deeds, like Esmeralda. That may not have had time to get back to them.
No way to have back then.
Yeah, but there is a lot in that song that Clopin talks about, that's all of the negative stereotypes of the Roman people.
And this is pretty much where we, in the book it straight up said it pretty much at the beginning, but this is where we're pretty much confirmed that Clopin is the leader of this tribe.
Yeah.
Judge, jury, and executioner. And another scene with the puppet. I object. Overruled. I object. Dang.
Yeah, that puppet, you know, just from the beginning with the, you know, who, what, how, I just love everything about that puppet.
So Esmeralda stops the execution and actually tells everybody that Phoebus has, you know, Phoebus actually risked his life to help a family. He's not one of them. He resigned his position just to go against Frollo. And
she a bit undersells it there. He didn't resign his position. He was like, okay, you can execute me. It's a little bit different.
He didn't quit. He was fired.
Yeah, he didn't quit. He was almost beheaded.
So, and they warned the people of Frollo's attack. But it's too late. Frollo's been following the two this entire time and led them straight to the court, and everyone is captured. And Quasimodo is locked in the bell tower, chained, so he never escapes again.
And not only chained, but chained where he has a good view of what Frollo plans to do next, which I think is an interesting extra bit of cruelty on his part.
Yeah, I'm going to make sure you never leave this place ever again, and I'm going to watch as I kill this woman you love.
Yeah, he's not locked in his room. He is chained to the pillars so that he can watch the executions.
Yeah. So in the morning, Esmeralda is set to be burned for the crime of witchcraft, and Frollo gives her the choice. Choose me or the fire. She makes her choice. Yep. Honestly, I would have chosen death too.
Yeah, probably.
And that was a good-ass loogie she put up on him, too.
Yeah.
So, and honestly, and as all of this happened, you have, like we talked about the freakish strength of Quasimodo. He sees Esmeralda is about to die, and he's just, I'm skipping over something here. He's very depressed. He's, you know, Frollo won. Frollo was right about everything, and it's like, this is the one scene where the gargoyles are justified in that, you know, what do we know? We're just made of stone. We thought you were made of something stronger.
Yeah.
And that one scene justifies them. Doesn't justify everything, but it justifies them being there.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing Esmeralda, seeing the fire, and he's just enraged. He is pulling those chains. Granted, he starts to break the chains, but he straight up breaks the pillars holding the chains.
Yeah.
That is, if you can't get rid of one problem, get rid of the root of the problem. So he breaks the pillars, breaks the chains, and it's a very, very heroic action movie sequence where he breaks the chain, swings down, rips the ropes off Esmeralda, swings, grabs her, climbs back up, holding her above his head and yelling, "Sanctuary! Sanctuary!" Which, again, is very reminiscent to the original film.
Yeah, and that is kind of a... probably the big set piece that all of the films have to put is Quasimodo screaming Sanctuary. It's kind of the one thing you know about Hunchback, even if you've never seen Hunchback.
Yeah. I was saying before, Tom Hulce, in doing the Sanctuary line, it was this line that he actually blew out his voice doing.
Yeah.
And you can tell, because he puts a lot of passion into that line.
I am going to say something about the animation here, because this is the part of the movie where we get the CGI.
Yeah.
There is a lot of CGI in this final fight sequence, and it starts here with Quasi swinging over
the people.
The people, you know, CGI crowd, CGI background, 2D animated, you know, stage and pyre, and, you know, all the main characters are 2D animated, and pretty much all the background is CGI. And then as it progresses through the next, you know, last bit of the movie in the final act, quite a lot of Notre Dame is then CGI'd. Mm-hmm. This is one of those, much like Aladdin, where about half of this does not stand up very well.
Mid-90s CGI. I could also compare that, what, I think the Toy Story came out the same year.
And yeah,
you have that comparison.
Yeah, but a completely different process in a lot of ways. There's something different about doing 100% CGI that I think holds up a little better than trying to mix the two. I think that if the entire movie looks like that, you kind of just, okay, that's just how the movie looks. Because if you go back and look at the original Toy Story versus, you know, Toy Story 4, that animation has come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
But Toy Story still holds up in a way that something like the CGI in Aladdin or Hunchback doesn't, because you have the contrast with the extraordinarily beautiful 2D animation and the early stage CGI, that there's something that the CGI just kind of falters in that comparison, because one holds up beautifully to this day and one looks not great.
So Frollo orders the doors of Notre Dame knocked down. And during all this, Phoebus knocks out the guard, takes the keys, and frees himself, and then he rallies the people to fight against the persecution of Frollo.
Once again, very fickle crowd.
Keep in mind that these were people who were wanting to see Esmeralda burn, and then minutes later are cheering Quasimodo as he's holding her up saying Sanctuary.
Yeah, I mean, this crowd. And also, they have brought farming implements to a public execution.
Yeah.
But no, I don't really think that you're kind of getting it culturally, because a public execution, even kind of a snap one, public executions were unfortunately in Europe seen as kind of a party, a kind of a, like, hey, we get a day off work and we get a, you know, we're going to watch somebody die and then we're going to get drunk. And, you know, I hate to say it, but they were kind of a minor holiday.
Come to ExecuCon.
Yeah, it was very much like that. You know, you see people with children and the crowd, and honestly, that was not uncommon. You know, it's like, bring the family. It's a family event. So the fact that they would show up with, like, you know, pitchforks and other tools of work is very weird. But the second that Phoebus is like, everybody get together, you know, then they all have like the typical torch and pitchfork kind of mob. And I'm thinking, no way. There's no way that all of these farmers would be like, let's go into the city to watch an execution and have a film and bring our work tools with us, you know. Yeah, I know. Cartoon. I think this has been another episode of Kiki Thinks Too Much About Cartoons, but, you know, it's one of those things that just, you know, pulls me out of it.
And I like what gets the people to rally against Frollo is that Phoebus is saying he's attacking Notre Dame herself. Frollo is literally attacking your religion. And it's like, that's been the key thing, like that's the people turning on him.
Yeah.
Anyway, the guards actually start climbing up Notre Dame, not even bothering waiting for the door to get knocked down, but Quasimodo and the gargoyles fight them off. This is another scene of, are the gargoyles his imagination, or are the gargoyles living beings? Because they're actually, you know, they make a catapult. They're firing bullets at the guards.
Yeah.
Laverne is sending her birds, flying monkeys, Wicked Witch style, complete with the Wicked Witch music, mind you.
Yeah, maybe this is where Stephen Schwartz got the idea.
So it's like, again, are these just his imagination, or are these actual living creatures? And we've completely ignored the love story between Hugo and Jolly for good reason.
Well, and once again, it's very much a one-sided infatuation there.
So it's a battle on two fronts, culminating with Quasimodo pouring a cauldron of molten lead, sealing off Notre Dame.
I always thought it was supposed to be oil.
Well, in the stage production that I did see, that he specifically said it's lead to fix the bells.
Oh, wow. I mean, you know, it makes sense that he would have a giant cauldron of lead. So I always thought it was supposed to be oil, because that was a very
common
typical
thing.
Yeah, that was very typical. And you do see that Notre Dame is fortified for a siege. There are parts of the architecture that are shown in the movie that do seem to have been made to withstand a siege. You know, you see iron work on the door that seems very defensive rather than decorative. It's a little bit of both, but, you know, it's why they're having such trouble breaking through the doors, is because there's wrought iron scroll work on the doors. You know, they are able to bar the doors pretty heavily. There are, you know, the water spouts in the gargoyles seem to be kind of strategically placed to also be able to deliver oil or hot lead. Which I think is one of the most beautiful shots in the movie.
Pretty sure Quasi killed some people with this.
Oh yeah. But is a beautiful shot, all the, you know, golden metal, I guess, pouring down around and encasing Notre Dame in this kind of protective halo, which I just think it's still beautiful. It's still a beautiful shot.
Yeah, Frollo was very lucky because he got on the other side of that. He was on the other side, the backside of water, as it were.
Yeah.
And he,
oh, look, it's the backside of lava.
And he makes it into Notre Dame anyway through the small hole that was broken into the door. The Archdeacon tries to talk some sense into Frollo. But Frollo just throws him aside. You will not interfere this time.
I'm actually shocked he didn't kill the Archdeacon.
Yeah, the way he threw
you know,
him.
He has a sword in his hand, and he is kind of lost his mind at this point.
Mentioned earlier in the movie too that, you know, the people are starting to think that Frollo had gone mad for attacking the mill.
Yeah.
So he's already lost his mind. Even the Archdeacon thing, have you gone mad? Why are you attacking Notre Dame? But, yeah. Anyway, you know, he locks the door behind him, make sure no one gets in that tower to stop him. And Quasimodo is kind of happy with his victory, but it's short-lived as it looks like Esmeralda has died. And here's our major change in the movie.
Yeah.
This is like the major change, and luckily they actually put this back in for the stage production. Spoiler, Esmeralda's supposed to die. So, enter Frollo, who plans to finish what he started and kill Quasimodo, the thing he wanted to do 20 years ago. Again, you know, Quasimodo says, you killed her. I had to. It was my duty to kill her.
Yeah, again, not taking any responsibility.
Yeah.
It's not my fault I had to kill her.
She was evil.
People expected me to. Yeah.
So, and the nice little, now I don't want to call it a fight, but it's kind of a shoving match between Quasimodo and Frollo. But Quasi, with that freakish strength, is able to fight him off. But he straight up refuses to kill Frollo at that point. He says, you know, like, you told me about the cruelty of the world, but the only cruelty is people like you. And again, that's a moral in this movie, is that, yes, the world is cruel, but there are cruel people in it. People who, let's be honest here, are using their own religious bias to persecute other people.
Yeah.
And that's still to this day. Let's look at the news in the last week.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, Esmeralda awakens. Again, the big change. Esmeralda lives. Esmeralda's alive, and Quasimodo's able to get her away. But Frollo eventually finds him. You know, they're hanging out on that. Apparently, the lead probably stopped pouring because they're hanging on that spout there.
Yeah.
And Quasi finally learns the truth, that his own mother died protecting him.
Yeah, his Roma mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's glossed over a lot how much these are also Quasi's people.
Yeah.
You know, that
he was told all of his life that his mother was Roma and that she abandoned him because of his looks, and that's not really what happened. And the book, it's a lot different. And it makes the parents out to be very cruel.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the book, they actually do. They pretty much switch kids, putting Quasimodo in one basket and taking Esmeralda. And raising Esmeralda as their own.
Yeah.
A little spoiler for an old book.
Yeah.
So anyway, in the fight, I guess, the two fall off the ledge. Frollo is able to swing onto one of the other gargoyle spouts. And as he climbs down, he's going to try to straight up kill Esmeralda. You know, and the righteous will smite the wicked. You know, all religious-like. And the gargoyle gives way as Frollo kind of slips on it. And then the gargoyle comes to life, yelling at him. Again, are these gargoyles independent beings? Or was this Frollo's own sinful guilt manifesting itself?
Yeah, we don't know. Because he, you know, he does actually see... Frollo himself at several points sees the statuary of the cathedral doing strange things. You know, from the eyes... staring at him in the beginning to the kind of, you know,
hellfire with the monks looking.
Yeah,
at him.
And the pointing, yeah. You know, hands in accusation and things like that. But once again, it is possible that in the context of the movie, he is also unhinged in seeing things for completely different reasons, of course, than Quasi. But
yeah, he's legitimately gone insane. And the it breaks off and. Frollo falls into the oil, lead, lava, whatever it is. He dead.
Yeah. Another Disney falling villain.
Yeah, another villain that falls due to his own hubris.
And the thing is that if he, this is very much a death of his fault, because just like Gaston, again, I really cannot say enough about the parallels between these two characters, but, you know, Gaston could have walked away, but he turned around and tried to attack the beast again, and that's what led to his death. Same thing with Frollo. He could have climbed back up and just left. But he sees Esmeralda in a vulnerable position. He still has a sword at hand, and he decides to try to kill her. Which is, you know, the reason that he ends up dying.
Mm-hmm. Again, another, the, well, in the book, pretty sure Quasimodo kills him.
Yeah.
So it's,
but
like,
we can't have that in a Disney movie.
We can't have our hero killing someone in a Disney movie. And as Esmeralda, he's holding on to Quasimodo, and he falls as well, but it's caught by Phoebus. Yay. And in that whole scene, Quasi ends up accepting Phoebus and Esmeralda being together. He puts their hands together and smiles at them. Like, it's going to be okay. I'm going to be okay, you two be happy.
Yeah.
Which is something that Frollo would never be able to do. So Quasi getting that, you know, bit of maturity there. And Esmeralda, Phoebus, they walk out of Notre Dame. They're celebrating. They're, Phoebus is holding his arms up in victory, holding up Esmeralda's arm. And then Esmeralda just turns back. Which, like I said, very similar to the original film. But Esmeralda this time goes back and brings Quasimodo into the, you know, out of Notre Dame into the light, and we see that young girl look at him and kind of accept him, and then the entire town accepts Quasimodo. Quasimodo gets a happy ending, yay!
Part of this ending, although not all of it, was partially Victor Hugo's idea. That he had done an operatic adaptation himself. And it has a slightly happier ending than the book. Phoebus dies. Mm-hmm. But I think the rest of them live. I don't know. I've never seen it all the way through. I just know little bits about it. But it was a slightly more faithful, at least to one part of Victor Hugo. Mm-hmm.
And we get that last reprise of Bells of Notre Dame, asking again the question, what makes a monster, what makes a man? And this time you actually see, when they say what makes a monster, you actually see the puppet of Frollo. And when I said what makes a man, you see Quasimodo being held up by the people.
Yeah.
Kind of giving you the answer. Who was the monster? Who was the man in the story?
Yeah, this is not subtle even for a Disney film in who exactly was in the wrong here.
Yeah. And, that's the end of Hunchback of Notre Dame. We do get the two songs sung by the pop stars. We get All for One singing the song Someday, which was a deleted song from the film, which this was supposed to be the song that was supposed to be played in the church instead of God Bless the Outcasts, God Help the Outcasts, which I think was a better option, was to use that song instead of Someday, because Someday's all right, but it just doesn't hit as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, go ahead.
Someday is not a bad song. But it is not as impactful. You're right.
And then, of course, we get a cover of God Help the Outcast by the Divine Miss M herself, Bette Midler.
Yeah.
Which, a bit of irony, considering not too long before this, she was in Hocus Pocus playing a witch.
Yeah.
So you got Winifred Sanderson, who literally went into a house because the guy was dressed as the devil, singing a song to God.
But, you know, not the first song in her repertoire about God.
You know.
She, one of her famous songs, of course, being From a Distance, which is very similar in tone as far as, you know, helping those who need help. But From a Distance takes us a slightly more secular perspective in a kind of we need to help each other. It doesn't necessarily beg God directly, but it begs humans to be more God-like in their love and generosity.
And so. Beth's version of God Help the Outcast is a bit more aggressive than the version that was in the film. Different lyrics, where Esmeralda's version was more, please help us, you know, we need you, why are you not helping us? Please help us, and Bette Midler's version was, why are you not helping us?
Yeah.
Again, both written by Stephen Schwartz, so take it up with him.
No. I think it absolutely fits Bette Midler's style a little bit more for it to be slightly more aggressive.
Yeah.
As that is, you know, more of her personality. In that brash and bold kind of style.
So that's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Does it still hold up? Is it still, I'm going to say yes, but mostly because of the gargoyles.
Yeah. I kind of hated the gargoyles even in the day. So that's not quite as much of a problem of a consideration for me. I mean,
if there was a way we can edit out the gargoyles from this movie, it'd be great. It'd be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of want like an Ebert cut of this movie or something where they figure out a way to remove the gargoyles from this story.
Or at least make it more that these are in fact Quasimodo's imagination.
Yeah, if you kind of make it clear that this is his imagination, it comes off a little better. And in fact, I think I would have been a bit more okay with the gargoyles if the humor hadn't been so juvenile.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the humor in the movie is incredibly witty. Mm-hmm. You know, all the stuff with, you know, Phoebus is just... And of course, Kevin Klein is just brilliant at throwing off those kind of lines. Yeah. But, you know, if it had been that kind of humor, you know, but it's like, yeah, it starts off with a fart joke, you know?
Yeah.
And the whole thing is, and once again, you know, yeah, okay, we're playing to the little kids, but give the little kids some credit, please.
I think it was more of, oh, you know, the kids really like Timon and Pumbaa. Let's make 3 Timon and Pumbaas, you know?
Yeah. As for the film itself holding up, I think it's better even as an adult. It was good. I've always liked this one, and I've always been sad that it was kind of the, you know, the poor maligned child of the Disney films.
And it made money. It just didn't make more than Pocahontas did.
Yeah, and...
That was, I think that's one of the big things that kind of hurt the film in terms of Disney recognizing it, because it did not outdo its predecessors.
And honestly, I think it's better than a couple of its predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think this is a better... I mean, I may change my mind when we do the Pocahontas rewatch, but I have always enjoyed this far better than Pocahontas. story-wise, I think this blows Lion King out of the water. Mm-hmm. Just as far as, you know, kind of the tight plot and the morals behind it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is such a great movie to me. With gargoyles accepted, everything about this movie is so really tight and constructed very well, animated very well. The shots of Notre Dame are beautiful. They really, really, really did their research. The actors, you know,
Demi Moore is a voice actor.
And honestly, as much as I like the song God Help the Outcasts, their choice for singing voice for Esmeralda is not, you know,
I think they just hired someone that sounds like Demi Moore.
Well, apparently, Heidi Mollenauer was somebody that Stephen Schwartz knew from Cabaret in New York. Mm-hmm. That she did a lot of Cabaret performances, not the musical, but actual Cabaret theater, Cabaret entertainment. And honestly, she kind of sounds like it. This is a woman who doesn't even have her own Wikipedia page, honestly. I am not saying anything against her necessarily, even though it sounds, you know, I'm sure she's a lovely person, and she does have a beautiful voice. But when you put her vocal performance up against somebody like Jodie Benson, or Paige O'Hara, or Leah Salonga.
At least you didn't say Bette Midler.
Even Bette Midler. I think Bette Midler sings it with a bit more passion. You know, like you just said, it's a bit more, yeah, aggressive. But I honestly think it's a bit more painful. In the sense of you really feel the pain of seeing people suffering in the Bette Midler version. So, honestly, it does kind of come across as they got a cabaret singer instead of a top-tier Broadway star, which is what they had been doing. Mm. And again, I'm sure she's a lovely woman and her voice is very nice, and I'm sure she does an amazing cabaret performance. But when you're working at the Disney level to voice a main character, you know, it kind of falls a little bit flatter than some of the other Disney heroines, you know.
All right, so there has been talk of a remake, of a Disney live-action remake. I haven't heard about this for about a year or so, but if it's still on the cards, would you be up for that?
If they get rid of the gargoyles.
Like I said, they sort of redeemed the gargoyles in the stage production by not making that, by pretty much making them figments of Quasi's imagination, not completely cutting out the song A Guy Like You, and kind of being more of his inner monologue of anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with it if you do it in that sense. You know, if they're, you know, a sounding board for him, and it's made very clear that he's kind of just talking to himself, and please cut that song, because it's not, no, I hate that song.
I would be more in tune with the stage ending, which, again, we've seen before, Esmeralda dies.
Yeah.
In the stage production, she actually dies due to smoke inhalation. And I think that would have, if Disney had actually done that and killed off Esmeralda in this version, it would not have been a G-rated movie.
No.
It would have been, and I think that's why they made the choice to not kill her off.
I find it very fascinating that you can murder parents with impunity in Disney movies. and still get a G rating. But I think we would have, I think you're absolutely correct in that if Esmeralda had died, they would have made it PG.
Yeah. I would be all for it. Again, it would, I've made my opinion on remakes in the previous episode. If they do something different with this movie, if they make it a way that you're telling the same story, but you're doing it in a way that hasn't been done before, or at least, or if nothing else, reduce the gargoyles and keep the original ending. They can make it work.
Yeah, possibly. And they seem to be more willing to go the kind of, you know, PG route with
I want the movie to end with a post-credit sequence of the two skeletons. Post-credit sequence, you see the catacombs of Notre Dame, and then, you know, you just see the skeleton of Quasimodo holding the skeleton of Esmeralda, and, you know, that's it. That's boom. It'll never get made, but I want to see it.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we'll get that mixed with the lovely Mencken and Schwartz music in that sense.
They say it in the stage production that they found two skeletons years later. They never show it, but I want to see it.
I absolutely love this film.
Underrated. Clearly underrated. Yeah.
Clearly underrated. If you haven't seen it in a while, do yourself a favor and go back and just give it an honest rewatch and let it be what it's going to be. I think
gargoyles and all.
Yeah, gargoyles and all. But I think as an adult, especially if you were younger when you first saw it, you know, like I said, we were in our teens. So I think we were starting to get a lot of the subtlety in the film. But as an adult, I think it's just a really gripping, and important movie with a lot of good moral content.
Yeah. Definitely shaped our lives after seeing the movie, you know, how we view the world today almost.
Oh yeah. And Out There and Hellfire really stand out as probably one of the better I Wants and definitely the best villain song for my money.
Yeah. So I think that's all we can say about it. We've been doing this for 2.5 hours now.
You knew what you were getting into.
This is episode 7. You already know by now.
Yeah.
So next week, we're going to go back to the movies we skipped. We're going to start with The Lion King next week, and we will see where we go from there. So tune in, guys, next week for The Lion King. And again, if you haven't seen it in a while, go watch Hunchback, whether it's on Disney Plus, whether you got the VHS, DVD, whatever, just sit down and watch it. It's a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you have time, go watch Lindsay Ellis's recap and backstory and stuff on this on YouTube. She does, I think it's a 2-part series, but she goes into a lot more depth than we did. So if you like kind of academic critiques of film, she does an excellent one of this, and I absolutely love her work.
I'm going to throw in one for John Solo. If you ever see him on YouTube, he also does a series where comparing the original work to the Disney version of Hunchback of Notre Dame. Definitely look up that video as well.
All right. Excellent. Got some homework for you.
So I think that's all we can do right now. We will see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.